dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It has been my distinct privilege and great pleasure to have been associated for a number of years now with a man who follows various aspects of this war for the free world with great skill and indeed an expertise that is desperately needed. His name is Kevin Freeman, no stranger to our audience, of course. He is the host of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and the driving force behind a terrific blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com. He is also a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and really our duty expert on economic warfare and how it's being waged against us and what we can do to exercise that domain for our benefit as well. Kevin, it's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be here always.
Well, so one of the battlefields in that economic warfare domain, of course, has been the running effort by Donald Trump to challenge what the Chinese Communist Party has been doing to us for decades, specifically with respect to predatory trade practices. But as you've talked about on this program and elsewhere, through a whole variety of other techniques that amount to unrestricted warfare. With that as kind of the predicate, I'd like to ask you about the trade deal, the skinny trade deal, as we're hearing it called these days, that was struck last weekend, the end of last week, I should say, that seems to have set the stage for further talks, perhaps even to complete this one, let alone something else. What do you make of it?
Well, the whole concept, the notion of a skinny trade deal, is frightening to me in that if we walk away from this with here's some concessions for farmers and we're going to buy lots more soybeans, but we don't address the deeper existential threat that China is posing, that's a serious problem for the United States. I suspect what the president was doing was giving the stock market a reason to rally, and it was a high-profile effort, but it does not appear. I mean, the Chinese said that there was no deal struck. The president said it was a substantive biggest deal ever, but there would be weeks more talks to take place. But if in fact, there is a true skinny deal where we let China off the hook for buying agricultural products, we've got serious problems.
And to characterize those problems, it would presumably be that we will see the Chinese continuing to do the sorts of things that we were trying to persuade them to stop doing, whether it's predatory trade practices or currency manipulation or theft of intellectual property and the like. But we'll also see ourselves presumably having essentially let them off the hook again, emboldening them and perhaps actually strengthening them, right?
No question about it. I mean, the least malevolent things that they're doing, which is stealing intellectual property and so forth, are still an existential threat to the United States. The most malevolent things that they're doing, which is controlling, threatening militarily, controlling space, taking our money to build weapons that would be used against us, so the thrift savings plan, as we've talked about, all of these things are horrifying, and And the least bad of them is, well, yeah, they occasionally do cut a corner here on IP and so forth. This is you use the term unrestricted war, which is the English translation of the book that was published in 1999 by the People's Liberation Army. But it is actually total war, and they are at total war with us. And if you doubted it, all you have to notice is that an NBA tweet can cause a threat. You will no longer be allowed to play games here. They won't be broadcast here and so forth. They're using economic power to threaten us in an act of total war. We can't speak against the nation of China, against Xi, or against anything else without the threat of repercussions and punishments. And this really, really is antithetical to the American system. It is an existential threat to the world and not just the United States.
Yeah, and this is, as you've indicated, evident in lots of different ways. Perhaps the most striking to lots of Americans probably was the imposition effectively of Chinese speech restrictions in the connection with this controversy over the NBA general manager who had the temerity to identify or express solidarity, let me say, with Hong Kong. This really brings home, doesn't it, just how expansive this agenda of the Chinese communists is.
Well, just imagine this. All right, LeBron James basically says you got to watch what you say because it's got repercussions. And he warns all of the NBA players, don't come out and say something as horrifying as we believe Hong Kong residents should have freedom. Don't do that. Now, it's okay to pause and take a knee and not salute the flag or sing the national anthem and so forth. It's okay to do that and to diss the American government all you want to. That's your free speech right. But by all means, don't say something even in favor of freedom for Hong Kong. So it just shows exactly how deeply China has embedded themselves in our system, exactly how they've gone about this total war concept, unrestricted warfare concept, to where you can't even say you're in solidarity with Hong Kong for freedom. It's not allowed any longer. Free speech controls. It's very, very frightening.
Yeah. And when you overlay on top of it the, well, I would argue, lack of patriotism or lack of commitment to our own country and its freedoms, this is ominous in the extreme. I think you're exactly right. Kevin, you mentioned the Thrift Savings Plan, and I did want to ask you about that quickly. A week from yesterday, the board that oversees this federal government retirement system is set to review a decision it made in 2017 to allow Chinese companies, or the practical effect of it would be to allow Chinese companies to gain access to at least a portion of the $500 billion that government employees, past and present, military personnel, serving and veterans, have in that fund. They may well hear from a Wall Street consulting firm that they've asked for advice on this that, oh, it's perfect, go ahead and do it. Should they?
There's no question they should not. Veterans, retired individuals who work for the government, patriotic employees of the government, current active service members should not be forced, if they want to diversify their investments internationally, to put a huge chunk of that into Chinese stocks where we have little understanding of what the companies are doing in the first place. And secondarily, where we have gotten some insights, we realize that these companies are literally aimed at our way of life.
Yeah, aimed at maybe even ending our lives, period. Kevin, I understand you might be able to stay with me for another block. Let me just carry this over to our next segment with Kevin Freeman. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back for a special extended edition of our conversation each week with Kevin Freeman, the Center for Security Policy's senior fellow specializing in economic warfare. He is also the host of a terrific television program at Blaze TV entitled Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. Kevin, we were talking about this, well, insanity is the only way I can describe it from a national security point of view, but also I would argue from an economic point of view of American retirement funds being used to subsidize or invest in companies that are doing malevolent things, contrary to our economic interests, contrary to our national security, indeed, perhaps even jeopardizing the lives of our men and women in uniform, if not those of us here on the home front. One of the things that has made this idea of having the thrift savings plan of the federal government put in the service of communist China's domestic repression and aggression overseas, all the more outrageous, it seems to me. And I want to get your view as an industry practitioner, a chartered financial analyst by training. How is it that on top of everything else, these companies do not have to meet the same standards for transparency and accountability as do their American counterparts?
Well, it is actually a part of the Chinese total war. It is access to the American capital markets. It's something that they wrote in detail. There are potential outright frauds of listed Chinese companies. Dan David has done a documentary, The China Hustle, in which he demonstrates that there are a number of companies that we think are great Chinese investments, but when you peel back the layer, it's actually a complete fraud where they've gone and put up a fake factory, or they've used an existing factory and put up a fake sign, and they'll take you through and it's the investor tour, and you think, wow, isn't this exciting? The next week they'll take the name off and put another new name on and do another one.
Potemkin villages.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. This isn't just, you know, a national security concern. It's an investment concern.
Material risk.
Yes, absolutely material risk. And the title is Chinese Stocks Lag Because Companies Neglect Shareholders in Barron's, where they say U.S. companies run for shareholder returns. Chinese companies are a lot like employment agencies. And if they're generating cash, it's used for pet projects of the government. They're not any interest of shareholders. And to force our servicemen and women, to force our veterans and patriotic employees and retirees of the federal government to invest in these companies that are dedicated not for their returns and their benefit like American companies would be, they're dedicated for the Chinese Communist Party's purposes, and those purposes sometimes are against our purposes. It really is scary.
But how do they get away with doing this without conforming to Dodd-Frank and Sarbanes-Oxley, for example? These require a level of transparency and accountability, do they not? And yet the Chinese don't have to conform?
Well, there's two real issues there. One of them is whether or not they're listed on American stock exchanges, and they should not be exempted from accounting requirements, but we've allowed that. We said, oh, well, they have their own accounting. The problem is their own accounting is a state secret, and they won't allow you to see it, so you have no idea if they're lying to you or not. They could, you know, be robbing you blind. Oh, it's a state secret, we can't share it, and we somehow overlook that. Well, that's ridiculous. That's a diplomacy problem that we have. We should mandate that they conform to the same rules. But the second issue is by having them heavily invested in an index. I've got no problem if you want to invest your money in an index that goes across different countries and has some money in Mexico and Singapore and Brazil and Austria and so forth. But in this particular case, we're mandating that the index is the way that you internationally invest for our government employees and pensioners. And by mandating that, we're literally forcing money to go in these things that are not researched. And this is a flaw of index investing that the Chinese are taking advantage of. It doesn't matter what the company does in the index. It only matters that it's listed in the index. It's automatically bought. And they understand how this works. In the United States, you have an index called the S&P 500 index, but all 500 companies are subject to U.S. accounting rules. And so when you make an index investment, you've got some reasonable certainty that you're getting something that's real. Not so the case with international indices.
Well, I think most Americans will be shocked that their pension funds, and even before we wind up compromising those of government employees and military personnel, Kevin Freeman, through state public pension funds, through institutional investors of other kinds, as well as individual investments. I think they'd be shocked to discover that there are these undisclosed material risks, and the Chinese are being enabled to get away with it. It seems to me it's not just a diplomatic problem. It's an SEC problem that is desperately in need of remedy and certainly shouldn't be compounded by adding the thrift savings plan into the mix. Let me ask you, Kevin, to switch gears, if I can, to another topic. Of course, we'll be discussing this more with Sam Faddis momentarily, but there has been this recent, and I'm afraid very unfortunate development, as you know, with respect to Syria and the extraction of the small number of American forces that were there essentially maintaining something of a modus vivendi, shall we say, between Kurds and Turks and Syrian government forces. There is now a somewhat chaotic situation that has developed as a result of those forces being withdrawn and the Turks coming in force. The reason I wanted to talk with you about this, Kevin, is President Trump made clear when he announced that he was going to move those forces out that if Turkey, you know, crossed some red line of sorts, that he would be willing to use economic warfare to devastate Turkey's economy. We've recently had the announcement, I believe last night, that the president is in fact going to be sanctioning steel exports by Turkey through tariffs, and perhaps other mechanisms will be employed as well. But what's going on here? Is it real, these punitive measures, and is it likely to be effective in mitigating very, very troubling Turkish aggressive behavior?
Well, I think the main point of this story is that economic weaponry is effective, but it can't be the only tool in the toolbox. The idea that you're going to stop a military aggression purely with economic sanctions is almost foolhardy. Just as an example, if you say I'm going to in your own personal home, I'm going to issue economic punishment to you if you rob my home, and they come in with guns and rob your home, there's very little you can do about it. And then after the fact, after this has happened in Syria, economic weapons themselves, as a threat, are relatively ineffective. There's just no abilities. Oh, if you do this, we'll sanction you. It works sometimes, but there are other times when military force is required. And when he pulled out our military troops, it put the region at risk in that sense. So we need to realize the proper role economic weapons have. Now, as an after effect, absolutely. There will be an effect. The Turkish economy is not a solid economy. We have the ability to implement measures against them that will hurt their economy, but they must have calculated this and taken into account when they made the decision that they did. So, you know, it really is an object lesson that there's a place for economic weaponry, but there's also a necessary place for having military force and capability, and we cannot just give on one and focus on the other.
Yeah. Well, this is, as you say, a tool, but not the only tool. And if it's not used effectively, I'm afraid it probably is discounted, as you've indicated might be the case with Turkey. I did want to ask you about one other thing about China. Let me jump back to that if I can. One of the other problems, as we discussed a moment ago, Kevin, with Chinese predatory trade practices has been their, generally speaking, sustained, disciplined, patient takedown of industry after industry in this country. There's been a report in the press, Kevin Freeman, about how the Chinese new C919 airliner that is apparently being designed to compete with similar aircraft by Boeing and Airbus was actually made possible by cyber espionage and theft of intellectual property. I'm sure this doesn't surprise you, knowing what you do about how the Chinese operate, but what are the implications of not only this kind of practice by the Chinese that evidently, again, if we go down the skinny route, on a trade deal is not going to be ameliorated. But also, Kevin, what they have long done in terms of their determination to put us out of business with such practices.
Yeah, well, CSO published an article yesterday that absolutely identified that the Chinese have literally stolen the technology necessary to build an airliner. And they've stolen it through intellectual property theft from the years. CSO is a respected publication in the IT security field. And this is something that China's been ongoing doing. They not only steal the technology to build their industry, but they will also use hacking and other means to take down their competitors when necessary. All of this is identified in that book, Unrestricted Warfare. And so what they've done is they've stolen plans for our stealth fighters. They've stolen plans now for this airliner. They've stolen plans for a lot of military components and civilian components. And they then build them with cheap labor and government subsidies and sometimes our capital, as we talked about from the Thrift Savings Plan. And they take our industry in its entirety.
Kevin Freeman, as always, I appreciate your time. Thank you for giving us a bit more of it than usual. We'll look forward to picking up with you again next week. We'll talk with you soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by one of the men that I turn to, well, reflexively, when it comes to matters involving strategic forces and nuclear arms control and deterrence. He is Dr. Mark Schneider. He has studied these things closely, but more to the point, practiced them in senior positions in the United States government as a Foreign Service officer, as a senior civil servant in the Office of the Secretary of Defense for decades. I had the privilege of working with Mark during my time in the Pentagon during the Reagan administration, but he went on to serve his country in that role for many years after. He is these days a senior analyst with the National Institute for Public Policy, truly one of the most important outfits in Washington, focused on these issues. Thinking the unthinkable is how it used to be called. And we're going to talk about the kind of thinking, perhaps not so unthinkable, that Vladimir Putin is doing now about nuclear war against the United States. Dr. Schneider, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
I want to ask you, Mark, to drill down with us on the military exercise that's apparently about to take place. We spoke with you a couple of weeks ago about another vast nuclear and conventional drill that the Russians mounted with the Chinese, among others. This is nuclear only, I take it, but give us a sense of the scale of what the Russians are up to.
Well, this is the largest exercise of they have ever announced. They are talking about an exercise, a strategic nuclear exercise involving 12,000 personnel, 213 launchers for ICBMs, up to 105 planes, including five strategic missile carrying bombers, up to 15 surface ships, and five nuclear powered missile submarines. So either they are suddenly being a lot more candid about what they've been doing, or this is off the scale, because I've never seen anything remotely like this in any of their briefings concerning previous strategic exercises, which they normally hold this month. This is on such a large scale that it's almost frightening. They are clearly practicing a all-out nuclear strike, which is sort of the last phase of their escalation ladder. There will be 16 live missile launches during the exercise. That includes four ICBMs and SLBMs, ARs, ICBM, Sinova SLBM, and two SSN-18 SLBMs. These are all MIRV systems, so this is not a tiny little strike we're talking about.
And of course, those acronyms stand for Intercontinental Range Ballistic Missiles, that is to say the ones that are able to reach our country from Russian territory, and then submarine-launched ballistic missiles, the SLBMs, that can obviously reach our country from launch positions in the broad oceans. Mark Schneider, there has been a practice in recent years of Vladimir Putin himself commanding some of these military exercises. Do we know whether he's going to be the man pushing the button? What we hope is a simulation, but very realistic, it sounds like.
Well, they haven't announced his involvement. That doesn't necessarily mean he won't be involved. Right now, he's playing a peace offensive. He's trying to pressure us on capitulating on the INF Treaty and going ahead with New START extension. So the scale of this and the scope of their announcements even more striking in light of that. They have gone this year from massive threats to peace offensives to threats, and now they're recently the peace offensive again, and now they're back to massive threats. And this is intended to intimidate. There's no question about that. In addition to the strategic threat against us, all of their fleets and flotillas are on the outskirts of Europe are going to be launching actual or simulated nuclear cruise missiles, and the obvious targets are in Europe because it's essentially nowhere else that makes any sense that they would be targeting. So this is a very, very dangerous type of thing. Now, I've said for a long time that there are fundamental differences between our exercises, nuclear exercises, and theirs. Ours focuses on deterrence. Theirs focus on warfighting. This is the most blatant example of that I've ever seen.
Yeah. This is such an important point, Mark, and it's hard to overstate its significance. As I said earlier, you know, we have had a history in this country of describing nuclear warfighting as unthinkable and unwinnable if it were to take place. You have taught me much over the years, Mark, about the very different attitude that the Soviet Union and now the Russian Federation under Vladimir Putin, I think of it as kind of a Chapter 11 reorganized Soviet Union. But the steps that they've taken over the years, not only to amass these stupendously threatening nuclear forces, particularly those that have resulted from the latest modernization effort, but also things like their comprehensive anti-missile and anti-aircraft defenses, and also their vast array of underground shelters, all bespeak a determination actually to fight and prevail in nuclear war, does it not?
Yes, and the deep underground bunkers that they reportedly now building a new generation of at Moscow really bring that message home. One thing about dictators, they tend to place a very high value on their own skin. And those these new bunkers that Bill Gertz is reporting are very much in line with that sort of mentality.
It's not necessarily designed to protect all of the people of this Russian, but the leadership, the party elite, the party elite, that's an old Soviet term, but it's the nomenklatura of today, the key industries, and obviously military commanders would be well protected, evidently, right?
Well, they are building a new civil defense system, including blast shelters. But these deep underground bunkers are completely different in nature. I mean, you're talking about things that will almost certainly be able to survive direct nuclear hits and will be extraordinarily difficult to take out.
Mark, let me ask you the pregnant question here. When you look, and again, our guest is Dr. Mark Schneider, a longtime duty expert at the Pentagon on these matters. When you look at what the Russians are doing now, the magnitude of this exercise, Just give us a sense of whether this could, in fact, be either the precursor for a preemptive attack, or at the very minimum, designed to desensitize us to the steps that they might take in the future for that purpose.
Well, that's certainly possible. The unknown scale of this would tend to have the effect of desensitizing us toward large exercises. I mean, 213 ICBM launches is about 70% of their entire force. Five ballistic missile submarines is over a third of their fleet of nuclear ballistic missile submarines, and even a higher percentage of the available ones, because at any given time some are under maintenance or refits or things like that.
Right, and you've said that these are equipped with multiple warheads, so this is a vast destructive potential that is being exercised, arguably sufficient to take out all of the targets they could conceivably think were needed to in our country, no?
Yes, this is not the initial phase of their nuclear operations involving a small number of low-yield nuclear warheads in a conventional war. This appears to be the final stage of their nuclear war concept, which involves massive nuclear attacks. And the selection of ballistic missiles that they are launching, they clearly, the two SLBMs that are being launched from the Pacific are clearly high-yield things. They've never modernized the SSN-18, so it's a 1980s high-yield system. So this is not the initial stage of some limited nuclear attack. This appears to be the final stage of a massive attack. Now, they probably ran the earlier stages in other exercises, for example, the Center 2019 exercise. It wasn't fought in Europe, but it had all the earmarks of a big fight against NATO, and a lot of nuclear-capable missiles were launched, real or simulated, during the exercise. And about a month ago, there was a dual launch of SLBMs. I thought, from the description of what happened, it was a small exercise. So that might have been, this is speculation, but that might have been the early...
Yeah, the precursor to the big laydown. But again, Mark, what this bespeaks, whichever stage of the exercise it is, what this certainly bespeaks is a deadly, serious Kremlin when it comes to the idea that nuclear war can be fought and can be fought decisively such that Russia would win. And this exercise that we're going to watch play out, well, today, tomorrow, and the following day, assuming it's just an exercise, is something that ought to remind us of how desperately needed is our own modernization of our deterrent so as to hold in check, hopefully, whatever a guy like Vladimir Putin may have in mind for us. Mark, this is just an introduction to a very, very important topic. We appreciate more than I can say your expertise in these matters and your sharing that expertise with us from time to time. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It is a distinct privilege to say that Sam Faddis is in the house. Charles Sam Faddis is, of course, one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, but it's always a treat when he's around because he brings such an extraordinary combination of talents and experiences and insights to bear on all of the topics we throw at him, and I'm sure this will be no exception. Sam has been a candidate for Congress. He has been a CIA operations officer in the clandestine service of our Central Intelligence Agency. He has been in charge of its weapons of mass destruction programs, and the monitoring of them, that is, overseas. He has served in the uniform of the United States Army. He has been an attorney general, assistant attorney general in Washington State, an attorney by training, an amazing Renaissance man, in short, and we're always delighted to have him with us. Sam Faddis, welcome back.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure to be here.
I could go on, but let me just also mention your terrific piece, the book Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, among your other works, and we'll talk about the coup that seems to have been emanating from the CIA against President Trump in a moment. But before we get to that, let me just talk to you a little bit about the crisis that is now in Syria once again. Sam, what do you make of what is happening there and what is likely to flow from it?
Well, look, I think there are obviously a lot of concerns here as to what's going to happen in regard to the Turks, the Kurds, centuries-old hostilities. I think all of those concerns are valid. I'm not going to try to sugarcoat any of that. But the way I look at this is we have once again in Syria ended up putting troops on the ground and taking on responsibilities without ever clearly articulating what the end game was and how this would all play out, other than just keeping troops in Syria indefinitely. And I think that this is a problem we have increasingly across the world, where we substitute the deployment of military force for somebody doing their job in D.C. in articulating a policy and a strategy. And I think it leads us inevitably to these kinds of moments.
And when you look at what is unfolding now in Syria, having withdrawn our forces in the absence of perhaps as clear a mission there as they should have had, do you anticipate that the vacuum thus created will be filled in a new, even worse conflict between the Turks on the one hand, who have now invaded Syria, and the Syrian government and perhaps its Russian and or Iranian allies?
Well, I think what will happen is into this vacuum will flow a whole bunch of forces. And many of them, as you have just outlined, are not friends of ours. And that will be the new reality on the ground.
And that doesn't even take into account the rise of Islamic State once again, no?
We could make a list that's about 5 pages long of ways that this is going to go badly and go sideways. I don't think what you're going to find is a protracted war between the Turks and the Kurds and the Syrians to begin with, because the Turks are going to find out very quickly that the Kurds they're talking about have about 150,000 guys under arms. And they're armed to the teeth, and they're now pulling in allies. And I think the Turkish military will discover very quickly after it's taken a few miles of Syrian territory that that's about all it's going to be able to chew with, unless they're going to go to the full mobilization, which they are not. So to that extent, I think this will bog down. But that doesn't change the fact that, yes, there will be all kinds of bad. I mean, we will no longer be controlling what's happening with ISIS. We will be irrelevant on the ground there. And every Kurd everywhere, without question, even if they have no connection to these guys in Syria, is going to look at this and say, okay, here we go again. The Americans have walked away from us, which I spent a lot of time in Kurdistan, and I heard a million times when I was there. And so there are definite downsides. I will not pretend otherwise.
Yeah. Knowing what you do of the Kurds, are you of the view that they are allies of ours and should be protected in a way that we are no longer engaged in doing?
So, going back to what I said earlier, what I think is that we need to articulate a clear policy and a strategy and one that we are actually willing to stand behind. So we start with the Kurds in Iraq. What exactly is our policy? If we are we supporting independence or are we supporting autonomy? And if so, what are we going to do about it? And then you move to very significantly different questions. Kurds inside of Syria, Kurds inside of Turkey, what is our attitude toward that and what are we going to do? We have never weighed in terms of the Kurdish-Turkish insurgency inside Turkey. We have never sided with the PKK or supported them against the Turkish government. So we're going to change that policy now? If so, Well, you can't do that and maintain anything like your relationship with Ankara. Maintain. Fundamentally, what I'm saying is somebody in D.C. needs to make clear policy decisions on this. Stop thinking that deploying troops on the ground is a substitute for a policy. They're there to implement it.
Yeah. I guess the nattering concern I have is that the takeaway from all of this, not just in the Kurdish population, but more broadly around the world, may be a lack of confidence in the reliability of the United States as a strategic ally.
That, I mean, frankly, I mean, not to take this to playground level business, but, you know, there is a fundamental principle here, which is we should not start fights that we are not prepared to finish and finish to our satisfaction. Better not to intervene than to intervene and then withdraw in this fashion. And before you put those guys on a plane, figure out why.
Yeah. A key point, Sam Faddis, said by somebody who's been on that plane and knows what it's like to have people in this country have your back or not, I'm sure. Let me ask you about another aspect of what you've been thinking about and writing about at andmagazine.com, Sam Faddis, and that is what's come to be called the coup against Donald Trump. The deep state comes for Trump. It's a piece that you wrote on October 8th at End Magazine. Give us your sense, Sam, if you could, about the role that the Central Intelligence Agency's senior leadership seems to have played, at least during the Obama years, and arguably some of those still running the place were implicated in that and may yet be playing some kind of role. Can you shed any light on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have said and written for some time that if you have this idea, I'm talking general public, that there was a coup against the President of the United States, an attempted coup, which I believe, I'm talking now the Russiagate situation, if that's what we call it, and you really think that that whole thing was handled by a half dozen people whose names are bandied about in the press, then you don't understand anything about how these things work, how deep it is, and how broad it is. So that was Q 1.0, and a half dozen people who were out of government were identified. That doesn't end anything at all. We are now into whatever the second or third iteration of attempts to depose this president. And by this point, we got to understand that there is a lot of people out there, including some at the senior levels of the CIA, who are still involved in this and are still sitting behind desks at LAMA.
And when you hear about Central Intelligence Agency personnel assigned to the White House serving as so-called whistleblowers, does that surprise you? Or does that sound as though this is just simply part of an operation run by people in senior positions in the agency against this president?
Without question, it is part of an op. And we should say that look, this is not intended to sort of with a broad brush paint everybody in the Central Intelligence Agency by any stretch of the imagination. But at the senior levels, without question, people are implicated. And look, you and I both know, going back to when we're talking to the original Russian allegations, you don't run an operation and then when it doesn't work, start figuring out what you're going to do next. You plan for how it's not going, for it's going to go sideways from the outset. And all of those plans for what you're going to do are made from the very beginning. That's all you're seeing here, and you will continue to see. I have no doubt the Ukraine thing will fail, and already now we've moved on to, I don't know, three or four other things that will be trotted out against this president. This will be continuous as certain people are removed.
Death of a thousand cuts, indeed. Sam Faddis, we have to leave it at that. This is no conspiracy theory. You have been inside the belly of the beast and have some deep knowledge of how these things work, and it's very appreciated that you share them with us. I hope you come back to us soon, and thank you for your service to our country in so many different capacities, Sam. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.